This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we bring you a special one-hour show dedicated to children in conflict with the law.
If you think this country has or had any humanity left, wait until you hear the horrendous stories of what we do with children who allegedly commit crimes.
Allison Parker from Human Rights Watch will join us to talk about the fight to stop sentencing children to life without parole in the United States.
Sentences of life without parole are prohibited by international law. They're an outrage, and these will be some of the saddest stories you ever heard.
Attorney Dave Berger, who represents people who were sentenced to life without parole for crimes they committed as children, will join us to talk about his firsthand experiences with his cases.
Almost every single child prisoner is held in the United States, but there's a major legal fight and political fight going on. State by state, activists and lawyers are trying to roll back these nasty, immoral laws.
And we'll bring you the history of how this all happened in the United States with Bernadine Dorn, clinical professor of law at the Children and Family Justice Center at Northwestern University.
Bernadine tells us why and how this occurred, and how fear engendered in the population by politicians allowed our country to be the only real country that on a massive scale jails juveniles for life. Stay with us. Welcome to Law and Disorder. This is Michael Ratner, president of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
I'm Michael Smith, New York City attorney and author.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, executive director of the National Lawyers Guild.
I'm Dahlia Hashad, director of the USA program at Amnesty International.
Here on Law and Disorder, we four lawyers and activists will strive to be your eyes and ears, your early warning system, your educators, counselors, and advocates. Here, we'll talk about the laws, practices, and procedures that we believe are strangling democracy. We'll be in the courts, in the books, on the streets, and here on the radio with you. We hope that we'll be lawyers you will like.
The great civil liberties attorney Bill Kunstler saw it coming. The police state is emerging, he warned. It's coming piece by piece, before and especially after September 11th.
States currently have laws allowing children, that's individuals under the age of 18 years, to receive life without parole sentences. We'll talk with Allison Parker, senior researcher at Human Rights Watch, about the legislation and the damaging effects of incarcerating children permanently without rehabilitative options. Over the last couple of years, Allison has been working with other groups around the country to repeal legislation in California and several other states. Welcome, Allison, to Law and Disorder.
Thank you. Allison, tell us a little bit about what's happening in California.
In California, there are 227 young offenders, by that I mean people below the age of 18 at the time of offense, who are currently serving life without the possibility of parole sentences in California's prisons. These young offenders are sentenced to die in prison. They have no opportunity for release. And this year, we saw an interest in this issue in the Senate of the state legislature. Senator Leland Yee has introduced a bill to eliminate the sentence so that no young offender in the state would receive a life without the possibility of parole sentence.
Allison, how long have these laws been on the books in California and generally around the country?
The laws mostly took effect around the country and in California in the early 1990s, and they came as a result of response to increase in juvenile crime, which certainly did happen at that time. Many criminologists associate that with the rise in crack cocaine use and the easy availability of handguns. But what we saw then were that states around the country, including California, made it more possible to try children as adults in adult criminal courts and to impose sentences that were extremely punitive, such as the life without the possibility of parole sentence. What happened soon thereafter, however, is that youth crime rates declined substantially, and yet these laws remain in place.
Bernadine Dorn, who we're going to have join us later on the show, spoke about this recently at a conference, and she says that actually that this rise in juvenile crime is more a perception than actual truth. Can you comment on that? Have you heard that argument?
Dahlia, I haven't heard that argument. What's wrong about sentencing juveniles to life without the possibility of parole is that, first of all, it's a sentence that takes no account of the fact that children inherently have the capacity to rehabilitate. It used to be that criminal justice in the United States had embodied within it a notion that offenders should have access to rehabilitative programs and that there was a purpose of rehabilitation in the sentences that this country imposed. The United States has moved far away from that, and in particular far away from that approach when it comes to juveniles, which is extremely unfortunate, first of all, because these are, as we all know, the members of our society who are most capable of growth and change. But secondly, because it is a very serious violation of the international human rights framework. Not only is it a violation of the Convention on the Rights of the Child, which specifically prohibits this sentence, but the United States is not party to that treaty, along with the country of Somalia. The U.S. is party to the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, which in two of its articles underscores the very premise that children should be treated differently from adults in any kind of criminal procedure or sentencing. And unfortunately, what this sentence does across the country is it treats juveniles just like adults and imposes a sentence that tells these young people that their lives are worthless and essentially throws them away.
What's it like in terms of the conditions in prison? They're not only thrown away, but then how are they treated once they get in? Do they have classes? What's it like for them once they throw them away?
Well, this is a question that I very much wanted to answer in the 2 years of research that I did. I traveled around the country and interviewed young offenders serving life without parole sentences. And what I found is that as a group, these folks are at the bottom of the list for any kinds of programs that exist in prison. And that is, frankly, as many correctional officials told me without any concern or sense that this was wrong, that since they will never reenter the community, why should we rehabilitate them?
I was thinking that when you said it, that I'll bet the answer is going to be, these people have no lives left, so why bother?
Exactly. Why bother? They won't ever come back to our society. There's no chance that they could be productive members of our society, and we're not going to spend our resources on them. One correctional official told me it's just a question of triage, and we're not going to spend the money on them.
The logic to this, of course, is then why just not execute them immediately? Of course, then if they execute them immediately, they couldn't provide jobs for the people that
Well, of course, they can't execute them anymore because of the Supreme Court decision. I'm interested in the relationship of the death penalty to these life without parole, particularly for juveniles. Of course, now you can't execute juveniles. I mean, people who commit crimes when they're under 18. And do you expect there might be, is there a push because of that to increase the number of juveniles without parole? Or is there some tension because of that within the community that you're trying to organize in?
Well, there is a little bit of tension, only because one of the realities is that lawmakers and individuals involved in the Supreme Court case, which found that the juvenile death penalty was unconstitutional, at certain times said, well, you know, the option is to sentence these people to life without the possibility of parole. And in fact, the Supreme Court case, Simmons v. Roper, Christopher Simmons, in that case, the sentence that he ultimately received when his death penalty sentence was overturned was life without the possibility of parole. That was the other option in his case. But the truth of the matter, and one of the things that we've seen in addition to that, is that juvenile offenders on death row have had their sentences commuted to life without the possibility of parole as the next most punitive option. But the truth of the matter in terms of international human rights law is that neither of those sentences is acceptable. Both are prohibited in exactly the same article in the Convention on the Rights of the Child, Article 37. And the point that the international community came to is the one that I made before, that for juvenile offenders, people who inherently have the capacity of rehabilitation, neither a sentence of death nor a sentence of death in prison, essentially, is appropriate.
Allison, you've been researching this, and what are you going to do in terms of trying to change this legislation?
Well, I'm working, and I have to say, in coalition with many individuals in other human rights organizations such as Amnesty International, juvenile justice advocates, people who come from a child development perspective, child psychologists, and concerned legislators, some of whom have admitted that when they passed laws that made it more possible for juveniles to stand trial as adults, they hadn't quite thought about how that would intersect with very punitive sentences like life without the possibility of parole. And so in various configurations across the country, there are groups of people working to end this sentence. And so now, as I mentioned, we have legislation pending in the state of California. There's a package of bills pending in the state of Michigan. And there are movements afoot in other states, such as Louisiana, Illinois, where people are really looking seriously at eliminating this very punitive sentence for youth.
I know in Colorado, the exchange was that the legislation that prohibited life without parole for children also, I guess, gave a maximum sentence of 40 years, or a minimum sentence, excuse me, of 40 years. Is there any kind of that compromise going on in the other legislation?
Yes, last year, in 2005, the Colorado State Legislature passed a law that eliminated the life without the possibility of parole sentence prospectively going forward in the state, which means that there still are 46 juvenile offenders who are serving life without parole sentences in Colorado, and substituted the 40-year sentence. That was a step in the right direction, although a 40-year sentence is still an extremely punitive sentence.
Oh, Allison, I just find it disgusting. I mean, you know, in Europe, they have maximum, 20, 25-year sentences, except in rare cases, for anybody, adult or juvenile.
Yeah, how does the United States stack up against the rest of the world in its incarceration of children?
Well, what I looked at with regard to life without the possibility of parole is, in the United States, we found 2,270 youth serving the sentence. I looked very carefully at the practices in the rest of the world, and based on government's own reporting, found only 12 youth serving life without parole in the rest of the world.
Say those figures again, will you?
There are 2,270 youth serving life without the possibility of parole sentences in the United States of America. When I looked at the practices of the rest of the world and based on government's own reporting, I found only 12 youth offenders serving life without parole in the rest of the world. And those 12 are located in the countries of Israel, South Africa, and Tanzania.
You know, how do you explain, how do we get to a situation like that in one of the richest countries on the planet? How did it come down to that?
Well, one of the historical facts of this sentence is that it originated from the United Kingdom. This was a sentence based on a common law sentence known as detention for the duration of Her Majesty's pleasure. And so in the first instance, you don't find sentences akin to life without the possibility of parole in countries that don't come from the English common law tradition. What you find are sentences more like 10 to 25 years for very serious crimes such as first-degree murder, whether they're committed by an adult or a child. So that's the first point, that the sentence of life without the possibility of parole is an artifact of English common law, and it's unknown for adults or children in the rest of the world. And then when you look at the ongoing use of the sentence in the United States, I think we have to look at that widespread hysteria, which we soon found was unwarranted, about youth crime in the early 90s. And we have to look at the fact that the United States has increasingly moved away from a rehabilitative model in criminal justice and has decided that children should be treated just like adults. We've become increasingly punitive against our youth.
In fact, I read that often laws are passed in response, as you mentioned, vis-a-vis the crack epidemic, but our laws are often the harsher laws passed in response to high visibility events such as the murder of a child or something that people respond to emotionally. And it's really left our criminal justice system as one of the harshest in the world.
That's absolutely correct. Whether you look at Colorado, where a lot of the life without the possibility of parole sentences and the way that the laws were changed came after the press seized on a few high-profile crimes committed by youth and labeled the summer of 1993 as the summer of fear. As a response to that, the laws changed. Other states, you see the same pattern. And one of the things that happened in those changes to the laws is that a sentence like life without the possibility of parole became a mandatory sentence upon conviction often for first-degree murder. In 26 states, life without the possibility of parole is the mandatory sentence. And so I think people have the perception that a judge is still able to tailor the punishment to the offender. If it's a child, perhaps he or she, the judge, will give some leniency and assign a different sentence. But the point is, under the laws that were passed, it's a mandatory sentence. The judge's hands are tied.
Allison, how have the families of these children been responding? Have they been active in trying to push for reforms?
Absolutely. In Colorado, in California, in Michigan, Illinois, Louisiana, a major force for reforming the laws are the family members of young people serving the sentence. I should say also that we've seen courageous people stepping forth who are the family members of the victims in these crimes. And in fact, one contact that I made, a very powerful conversation I had, was with a woman who was both the aunt of a young person who is serving life without the possibility of parole, as well as the mother of a young man who was killed, and the perpetrator of that crime is now a youth offender serving life without the possibility of parole. So there are people coming together both from the perspective of, you know, family members who are the parents of those serving the sentence, as well as those who are the family members of the victims, to oppose the sentence, basically because they believe that these young people should have an opportunity to go before a parole board and to evidence whether or not they have rehabilitated themselves, and if they have, they should be able to return to the community.
We're talking to Allison Parker from Human Rights Watch, who's just concluded a study on the extraordinary phenomenon here in the United States of children under the age 18 serving life without parole. Allison, if our listeners want to get active or more informed in this, you got a website?
Yes, you can go to the Human Rights Watch website, which is www.hrw.org. And if you're more interested in, or if in particular you're interested in the law in California, you can go to childrenwithoutparole.org, which is a separate website that includes a videotape that interview that I did with a young woman serving the sentence in California, as well as more information about the pending bill in the state to eliminate the sentence.
We'll post those on our website, too, which is, Dahlia?
LawandDisorder.org. And on there, we'll also have a link to AmnestyUSA.org, which has a map. It's being put up as we speak of the United States. You click on your state, and it'll tell you if there's something you can do and how to do it.
Allison, it's been a pleasure to have you on, and we look forward to hearing some positive developments from you in the future.
Thanks so much for having me.
Thank you, Allison.
Thank you. That was Allison Parker, senior researcher at Human Rights Watch.
Today we're pleased to have joining us David Berger, an attorney with the law firm of O'Malveny and Myers. He's also pro bono counsel to Amnesty International and has represented many individuals who were sentenced to life without parole as juvenile offenders. Dave, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Dave, can you explain what exactly is the issue of children sentenced to life without parole?
Sure. Well, it's a very dynamic issue that's fairly large in scope, but I'll try and sum it up briefly for you. The United States is the only nation in the world that, to such a great extent, sentences children to life without parole. In the United States, we've counted 2,225 child offenders who are serving life without parole. That's compared to only 12 in the rest of the world. It means exactly what you think it means. Lock them up, throw away the key, dispose of children who've made mistakes, but are being held accountable in a way that goes well beyond their culpability and their capacity for redemption and rehabilitation.
So can you tell us about some of the cases? Because when I was first introduced to this issue, what shocked me, in addition to the fact that we were sending, as a country, that we were sending children to prison for life without ever saying, okay, in 10 years, in 20 years, in 30 years, in 40 years, even in 50 years, we'll have a parole board look at your case and see where you've come. Even putting that aside, one of the real things that shocked me was that a lot of these juvenile offenders are in prison for things like felony murder, which means that they weren't they were part of another crime. They took part in another felony, say robbery, and another individual who was a part of that crime, a co-conspirator.
In a number of states, Dahlia, you have what I term a perfect storm. You have the sentencing of children to life without parole, mandatory sentencing, and felony murder laws, along with direct file laws. Those four sets of laws, types of laws, together create a perfect storm whereby a prosecutor, with very little oversight and discretion, can lock up a child for the rest of his life.
David, what's a direct file law?
There are different ways that a child offender who is being charged can come before an adult court. In many states, there is a judicial transfer hearing where a judge makes a determination of whether the child should be tried as an adult or in the juvenile system. But in many other states, direct file laws permit prosecutors to make that judgment with little oversight by the judiciary.
I don't think many people understand that there is an ability when, you know, if a child, if a 13-year-old, 14-year-old, whatever, commits a crime, that they can often be tried as an adult without any type of mitigating circumstances being introduced about the fact that their brain's not fully developed, that they're, you know, teenager making bad decisions.
That's right. That's right. And while I would certainly advocate for transfer hearings over direct file, let's not lose sight of the fact that even these transfer hearings often are not fair. You know, we're in a situation where a child is asked to assist his counsel in preparing his case. And simply put, children aren't able to understand the intricacies of the judicial system. And that leads to unfair hearings.
Well, can you tell us what's the problem with having someone tried as an adult instead of a juvenile?
Well, when a child is tried as an adult, he is exposed to the litany of punishments that adult offenders would be exposed to, including the sentence of life without parole. And sentencing a child to life without parole is a violation of international law, you know, the International Convention on the of Civil and Political Rights and the Convention on the Rights of the Child. And not to mention, it's simply unconscionable.
So a child can indeed serve, even if you outlaw child life without parole, a child could serve the rest of his or her life in prison, but they would just simply get the opportunity.
Right. What Amnesty International is advocating for is not the certain release of child offenders. I, for one, don't want violent, dangerous people out on the street. What we're saying is that children change. They mature. They grow up. No one is the same person they were when they were 14 or 16. And all we're advocating for is for these cases, for these individuals' level of rehabilitation to be reviewed by a parole board, which I'm sure you and your listeners know. Parole boards are notoriously, they do not simply release every other prisoner. They're very tough. But all we're asking for is for parole boards to review these cases once these people have matured and grown up and reached adulthood.
So, Dave, you've taken on a number of these cases pro bono. Can you tell us about some of them?
Sure. Each case is very different. Without going into specifics, there are some instances of clients who simply just did not understand the future consequences of their actions when they took them. There are others who were addicted to drugs and were their brains were even less developed than their 14 or 15 or 16-year-old age would suggest because of their addiction to drugs. Their brains really hadn't developed since the age of 11 or 12. There are others, with some of the saddest cases, I think, where children who simply were hanging out with the wrong crowd because of felony murder laws are in jail or in prison for the rest of their lives with no possibility for a parole for being in with the wrong crowd, being the lookout when a murder occurred that they had no intention of occurring, that they did not know was going to occur, but they were involved in some other sort of crime when that murder occurred.
You know, David, what's amazing to me is how hidden this issue has been for a very long time. I mean, I'm a human rights lawyer, a civil rights lawyer, and you know, I barely knew about it, and now it's starting to come up more, but the situation you're describing is so egregious. I mean, I just find it utterly shocking. I mean, what do you see as one of the – why has it been so hidden, and what do you see as the potential over the next couple of years to finally at least get parole hearings for people?
Well, I think many people in the civil rights community had recognized this issue years and years ago. However, because child offenders were still being executed, the focus of the children's rights and human rights community was on ending the execution of juveniles. Once the Roper decision came down, this really is the new frontier in just punishment for child offenders. And again,
Roper outlawed juvenile executions. And by juvenile, I don't be given the age. It means if you commit the crime when you're under 18. Is that right?
That's correct. Yes. And you know, and the Supreme Court's findings. You know, if I could just very quickly quote from the Roper decision, the Supreme Court held that any parent knows, and scientific and sociological studies tend to confirm, that children possess a lack of maturity, something we all know, an underdeveloped sense of responsibility, again, something we all know, and take impetuous and ill-considered actions and decisions. In other words, kids act out. And, you know, it took a Supreme Court decision for our law to recognize that, but while we recognize that, with the death penalty, why don't we recognize that when, in this sentence, which I'd term the natural death penalty, the life without parole?
What happens to people? I mean, you followed the cases of people who are now adults and have spent probably more time in prison than they have outside of prison in their entire lives. What happens to people who are sentenced to life without parole as a child?
In the saddest cases, where child offenders are put in with adult prisoners, which I will admit is a rare but intolerable circumstance when child offenders are put in cells abutting adult offenders. The abuse that they face is horrendous. In other situations, they're taken advantage of by guards and really in their own way tortured in the prisons by their surroundings. And over time, they grow up and adjust to prison life, but they never have a chance to live outside of prison. They never have what I would say their first chance. You know, our report is called Second Chances, but I think that the first time you really get a chance in life is when you're an adult and are able to make adult decisions. You know, childhood is a period where you're maturing and you're practicing. It's not really until you're an adult that you get your first chance at life, and they never get their first chance.
Can you say something, David, a little bit about the strategy? I know that some 42 states allow juveniles to be given life sentences without parole. And is the strategy to try and go state by state or ultimately get a case to the Supreme Court? I mean, what is the overall strategy?
Right. Well, you mentioned because there are 42 states that still have life without parole sentences for child offenders, we don't have the national consensus around the issue that the Supreme Court noted in the Roper decision. In the Roper decision, the Supreme Court said, because so many states have ended the execution of child offenders, it is unusual and therefore can be unconstitutional as cruel and unusual. Here, because 42 states still permit it, we don't have that same argument, and the Supreme Court won't accept that same argument. that there is a national consensus. So we are going state by state. Legislation has been passed in Colorado, although not perfect. It did end the sentencing of children to life without parole. There is legislation pending in and introduced in Florida and Michigan and California. We have grassroots activists on the ground in Iowa and Massachusetts and other states, all working to introduce and pass legislation that will end the sentencing of life of children to life without parole. After we've gained what we'd consider a national consensus among state legislatures, then we will take up a litigation strategy. But I think a litigation strategy at this point is premature.
Wow, it's really, I can see it's going to win in the end, but it's going to be a long struggle. I mean,
it will.
Yes.
Well, thank you very much again,
thank
David.
You.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.
Joining us today to talk about the history of juvenile justice in this country and the development of draconian laws for children in conflict with the law is Bernadine Dorn. She's a clinical professor at the Children and Family Justice Center at Northwestern University in Chicago. Welcome, Bernadine, to Law and Disorder.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure.
Bernadine, on the show, we've been exploring the issue of children sentenced to life without parole, and there's been a lot of recent activism in various states on this issue. It's come to our attention that these laws that are so harsh for kids weren't always so. Can you tell us a little bit of background on where they came from?
Well, let's go back for one place to an April night in 1989 in Central Park. Kind of a lovely spring night, you'll remember, where a 28-year-old jogger, a white investment banker, was found. Her body was found raped, bludgeoned, three-quarters of her blood lost, and in a coma in the underbrush of Central Park. That story, in many ways, became not only was a parable about American racial and gender history, which it surely is, but became a story that led to really an epic and unprecedented kind of criminalization of youth that went on for a full decade, and we're not out of the woods about it yet, meaning that we started arresting and charging our kids with crimes for what in many ways is normal adolescent behavior. Of course, this became thoroughly defined by race and class. But I'll just remind your audience, many people are so too young to remember what really happened in that Central Park jogger case. Within about 24 hours, five young African-American men were arrested. African-American and Latino men were arrested. Headlines throughout the world about wolf packs and Wilding and Clockwork Orange. They were interrogated for 24 hours, two of them with their parents present. They confessed on videotape to the crime, although there was not a single piece of forensic evidence linking them to this brutal assault. The woman herself survived and had no memory of the events of that evening after leaving her house. But not a single piece of forensic evidence linked these youngsters to the crime. But the media found it to be black kids, white woman, rape, violence, invented the kind of, became the catalyst, really, for a decade of reporting on violent youth super predators. The kids were tried and convicted. Collectively, they served 40 years in New York State Prison. Of course, the bizarre thing about this story is that there was another confession 13 years later, a man named Matias Reyes, 31-year-old serial rapist, wrote a letter to the state's attorney in New York, to the district attorney, Morgenthau, confessing to this crime. And tests and an extensive year-long investigation revealed that he indeed was not only the rapist and attacker of this young woman, but was the sole attacker. That case, the demonization of those kids, who were, by the way, all in school with two-parent families and from relatively decent neighborhoods and so on. You know, you can go backward and look at the history, long history of lynching and executions in America, or you can go forward into the next decade of the 90s, where you had a group of academics led by John DiIulio, but involving other professors, James Q. Wilson, James Fox, who began to warn citizens through editorials across the country and academic papers that we were about to face a rash of youth crime by remorseless kids who had no respect for human life. DiIulio projected a demographic crime bomb where he said that a group of kids growing up surrounded by, and this is a quote from him, deviant, delinquent, and criminal adults in abusive, violence-ridden, fatherless, godless, jobless settings, and so on, would be going after, in particular, white people. And so you had kind of the official sanctioning for really a new wave of arrests, of long-term incarceration, of detention, and of extreme sentencing for our kids. I've never really quite known how to explain this, because it seems to me, while particularly African-American kids and immigrant kids have always faced a harsher justice system, the notion that our greatest fear is our own young children seems to me maybe unique in human history. I sometimes think it's because it came between the end of the Cold War and the beginning of the so-called War on Terror. But for a full decade there, it seemed to a lot of people, I think, that the scariest thing was a violent youngster who might be coming through your windows or entering your school in the middle of the night.
Well, Bernie, what have been the consequences now, fast forward to 2007, in terms of the incarceration rates, police procedure, judicial procedure?
Right.
You know, what's happened as a result of that false scare?
Well, two things have happened. One is we have a dramatically increased number of kids who are incarcerated and detained and charged and sentenced with extremely long sentences, longer than pretty much anybody else in the world would sentence their kids to. So you have, in the war on drugs becomes another kind of facilitator for this process. You have the incarceration rate today, for example, of African-American youngsters is four times that of white kids. I'll just give you a tiny example. Young people of color are 34% of the youth population, 62% of the number of kids in detention, that's pretrial, 66% of the youngsters in correctional facilities, locked facilities, and 75% of the youngsters who are locked up with adults in adult prisons. So the deeper you go into the system, the more extreme the racial disproportion, but the numbers are overwhelming. In a way, sometimes I say we have two systems of justice in America. We have one, which is the public system for punishing and crushing and humiliating children and their families of color, and the other one, really not visible, a private juvenile justice system, protective, effective, confidential, where kids are taken out of their settings, and whether they're put in a mental health or a drug treatment facility or a private school, the goal is that they recover and that they don't get further into trouble. So that, we once had a volunteer lawyer who was sitting waiting to pick up a case in delinquency court with us, and after about 5 minutes he whispered, really without irony, "Where is the white juvenile court?" This was in Chicago. But that's what you see when you go into our major cities. You would think that white youngsters don't break the law. Of course, we have tons of evidence that white kids break the law at the same or slightly higher rates than African-American kids or Latino kids, but you wouldn't know it from that. The second kind of thing has been the creation of a new pipeline. We call it the school-to-prison pipeline, by which kids get criminalized. And that happened right in the middle of the 90s, 94, 95, almost without anybody looking. But what happened was that schools across the country adopted zero-tolerance policies. I think it was in the context of these nightly news reports about violent youth, the handful of school shootings, which, by the way, were all done by white kids, by white boys, pretty much all in suburban schools. But nonetheless, the image of the child shooter remained one that was going to punish kids of color. And so what happened is that in the name of keeping guns out of schools, a federal law was passed, the Gun-Free School Act. The next year it was amended to use the word weapon instead of firearm. And we now know a weapon can be a ballpoint pen or a memory board or practically anything. It mandated kids being expelled from school for up to 2 years for breaking the rules. And it's a fascinating phenomenon because across the country, school boards on a local level and as well as on a state level adopted rule books that are as big as old telephone books used to be, trying to come up with every possible misbehavior that a school child could do and the appropriate sentence for it. And so we have the phenomena now of hundreds of thousands of kids being arrested in schools every day, taken out of schools in handcuffs, and taken to the police station, and then being suspended, at least, and sometimes expelled from school. It's rather a great irony. This fall is the 50th anniversary of Little Rock, right, of the integration of Central High School by these nine unbelievably courageous 14 and 15-year-old youngsters 50 years ago today. And I sometimes think, you know, the school door was broken open in the front of the school building. And now, 40, 50 years later, those same kids are being pushed out the back door. Overwhelmingly, very well documented, these kids are being arrested for nonviolent, non-harm-creating offenses. Disorderly conduct, you know, dress code violations, verbal little fights or pushing things, graffiti, you know, nothing. Charges. I mean, charges that should be sanctioned on some level, but not by the criminal justice system.
No, really. I wanted to remind our listeners that we're speaking with Professor Bernardine Dorn, who teaches law at Northwestern Law School. She's the clinical professor there involved in juvenile rights. How did you get involved in this aspect of human rights law?
Oh, it's a pretty practical set of decisions. I was at a turning point in my life. I had to decide kind of what to do next. And, sort of at middle age, and I had three young kids, one of whom was in a lot of trouble, and I decided to kind of pick an area of the law that matched my life today. And I went to work in the juvenile court of Cook County on the west side of Chicago as part of a class action litigation unit.
Bernadine, can you talk to us a little bit about where the laws sentencing juveniles to life without parole came from?
Well, as you know, the United States is wildly out of sync with the rest of the world on these questions of sentencing juveniles and adults. So these laws have existed for a while, but many states adopted them and really only started using them right in this period of time that I'm talking about, the late mid to late 80s and the 90s. In Illinois, we're about to come out with a report on the 103 people in Illinois who are serving life sentences without the possibility of parole for events that they were convicted for when they were children. Most of them were sentenced during the 90s. It's fallen off again dramatically. So you can really see a kind of a bell curve in this sentencing. So I think it was tied to this demonization of youngsters, this criminalization of youth that we talk about, the harshening of sentences and mandatory sentences. So two things happen. One is kids now, a lot of kids, even for nonviolent offenses, mainly for nonviolent offenses, get tried as adults in adult criminal court. And then they come under the rubric of mandatory sentencing. So we, in our report, will have a lot of examples. Maybe you'll have me on again next fall when I can quote from our report.
Absolutely.
77% of this 103, by the way, are African-American youngsters. But I think the point of this is that we have examples where judges are saying, I don't want to give this sentence. It's not appropriate. This is not what I want to do, but my hands are tied. So I think the trial of kids as adults and then mandatory sentencing has made this somewhat inevitable. We have really good law now, Supreme Court constitutional law, saying that children who break the law, even for murder and very serious offenses, are categorically less culpable than adults. And we have a lot of science, you know, picture-perfect pointer kind of science showing the trajectory of adolescent brain development, which every parent and every youngster already knew without the PowerPoint. And so we know that kids are different than adults, and we know that they are less culpable and that they can recover. So someone who commits a murder as a child obviously is going to be incarcerated. Life without possibility of parole, that's being sentenced to die in prison. It's a ominous, really, and terrible sentence. You would know about it, Michael. It's not unlike being in Guantanamo, in a way, right?
No,
no procedures,
right.
No hope, no...
And no way out, really, is
prospect,
really
nobody to talk to.
It's unimaginable, kids, really.
It's unimaginable. They're kids.
I find this to be...
Coming to grips with having done something terrible...
You know, Bernadine, I didn't know much about this issue until we started interviewing people over the last few weeks. I just find it impossible to even understand. It's so devastating to me. And of course, they say we're not going to give them any services or education because what's the point? They can never get out.
That's what I was going to say to you. They're all in maximum security prisons, so they don't get any the tiny bit left of education or exercise, anything.
No, it's just unimaginable. I mean, you and I, all of us, many of our listeners have had children and who are young kids, 14, 15, 16, 17. It's unimaginable that they'd spend the rest of their lives in some maximum security prison.
It's really unimaginable. And you probably know, since you've been pursuing this, that a quarter of them are, you know, what we call accountability murders or felony murders.
Yeah.
They were not often even at the scene.
Now, we heard some shocking stories about that. I mean, unbelievable stories about that.
So what are you doing personally to try to do something to stop and reverse this?
Well, we've been part of a national network of people. You know, there's a whole national juvenile defender network and organization working across the country to try to do better at the trial and arrest level, to try to reverse this trend, you know, that happened, that has even now, I think people realize now that these harsh laws that they passed really make no sense. Whether there's a political climate in legislatures that allow people actually to reverse it remains to be seen. But it's a very costly system, for one thing, and even while it's humanly a devastating system. The fact is that people, there's a lot of evidence that young people can come to grips with what they did, understand how it harmed other people, and, you know, want to devote themselves to leading a good life and making amends, restorative justice. We've done a lot of work here in Chicago. We have a wonderful, now independent organization that used to be with us, doing community-based restorative justice, where, you know, kids who break the law go in front of a panel of people at their local library and have to talk about what they did. The victim can come and talk about what it meant to them. And then an agreement is reached, and if they stay out of trouble for the next while, they don't have a criminal or a juvenile record. So, there, you know, we know the answers to these things because we do them for white and privileged kids. You know, we get calls all the time. If you're in this world, you know, where our friends and our kids' parents are calling about kids being arrested, sometimes for junk and sometimes for serious things. And, you know, I think because the white system is so effective, we should have it for everybody. We know what to do. You remove kids from the situation that got them into trouble. You have eyes and ears and arms around them for the period of their turbulence, and then they grow out of it. And you do that without scars, without crushing them and caging them. And they don't have a record. That's every privileged parent's goal for their kids. That'll haunt them and that'll prevent them from going to college and getting scholarship money and getting jobs and having loans for housing. I mean, the tracking now of somebody who commits a juvenile offense late into their adult lives is astonishing. And yet we have this Supreme Court doctrine saying, you know, categorically less culpable. Children are categorically less culpable. So we're for second chances, and there's lots of examples of second chances at work.
Bernadine Dorn, clinical professor at Northwestern University in Chicago, working on juvenile justice issues. Can you please tell us where listeners can go if they want to learn more about what you're doing?
Ah, it's the Children and Family Justice Center at Northwestern University School of Law, and it's in the Bloom Legal Clinic.
We'll put that up on our website. Bernadine Dorn, thank you very much. It's good to know that somebody like you is doing what you're doing. And we'll invite you back on Law and Disorder as soon as you'd like to be here.
Thank you so much.
Thank
it's a
Bernadine.
Pleasure to talk to you all. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye. That was Bernadine Dorn, clinical professor at the Children and Family Justice Center at Northwestern University, talking about juvenile justice in this country.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org.
You can tell us what you think or listen to a past show. The ideas expressed here on Law and Disorder are our own and not those of the organizations for which we work. Thank you.
cazar. Y si lo llego a lograr, seré un guajiro dichoso.
A caballo vamos pa'l monte, a caballo vamos pa'l monte, a caballo vamos pa'l monte, a caballo vamos pa'l monte.
Porque el campo es el Edén más lindo del mundo entero.